other commitments. As far as reportable on our closed session, nothing reportable on 4. On 5, considering Lori Curry, we approved a non-service, a connected disability. On item 6, for Nancy Marcelli, that was referred back to a hearing officer for further proceedings with instructions. For item 7, connection with Lawrence Nunes, we adopted the proposed findings and recommendations of the hearing officer. On item 8, we referred back to the matter back to the hearing officer for further proceedings with written instructions, and there is nothing reportable on either items 9A or 9B. Okay, we are now in open session. Presentation number 10, presentation from McLaughlin.
So today we have Mike Oak here from McLaughlin. You'll remember a few months back the board had decided to use McLaughlin to do an investment compensation study of Cicero employees, and today he's here to present his report.
Does everyone have a copy of the report?
I do.
Great. So I'll start with a little bit about McLaughlin. It's in the back, but just give the elevator speech in case you're not familiar with us. So for about 40 years, we focused exclusively on compensation within the financial services sector. Within that sector, we worked with banks, insurance companies, and asset management firms. Within the asset management space, we have 700 clients in North America that would fall as an asset manager, including obviously public pension funds, corporate pension funds, endowments, foundations, family offices on the institutional owner side, and as well as the actual manager side like Fidelity and BlackRock, et cetera, and then hedge funds and private equity firms and every flavor in between. So for those group organizations, all we focus on is pay levels and pay structure. So that's salary levels, and then to the extent those organizations have incentive plans, how and why those plans should be structured. So is that clear enough of what that's my day-to-day, for better or worse? So this analysis was focused on the looking at salary levels for the investment people here. As indicated on page 2 of the overview, we looked at three groups. We looked at within the surveys, McLaughlin conducts these compensation surveys where each of the participants listed supplies to us every one of their employees and how much their salary is and what are their positions, et cetera, et cetera. So we looked at, within our database, we looked at three groups. We looked at the small public pension funds that are AUM less than $15 billion. We looked at the broader sample of all public pension funds. And then we looked at the private sector incorporating investment management firms, investment arms of banks, investment arms of insurance companies, corporate pension plans, endowments, and foundations. So that's what we call the private sector. And a summary of those firms are listed in the appendix, I believe. All clear so far? So page 3 has the recommended ranges that we got to, as well as your current range. So that's like, that's the meaty page, but it probably makes sense to go through where those numbers came from and how we got there. So I'm gonna come back to page 3, which has the recommendations, but I think sort of walking through the process to set the stage is a good start. So on page 4, this is where our philosophy and the public funds that we work with, most of them recognize that while they are a public pension fund, which is that darker colored gray ball on the bottom, that they compete with a wide range of private sector firms and public sector firms. Some of those are mission-driven, some are not. And if you think about the sample of, if let's say your CIO were to win Powerball tonight and say, I don't need to come to work next week, and you say, well, we want to hire a new CIO, the labor market or the talent pool that you'd be recruiting from is much larger than the public funds, and it's tens of thousands of people, mostly within the private sector. But we tried to, in our analysis, we try to have a balance of public and private data. But our feeling is that we wanted to present you with as much relevant data as possible representing this broad labor market that we view. So on page 5, going over the chief investment officer position, again, as we mentioned before, I'll talk about what the numbers mean, but we looked at those small public funds, which are the public funds less than $15 million, all public funds within our survey, and then for this position, we looked at small private sector firms. So we looked at less than $15 billion. So this isn't including like Larry Fink or anyone like that. So while there still might be some outrageous numbers on there as you see the numbers, we thought a reasonable cutoff of $15 billion using the same AUM was appropriate to say what's the private sector comparison. So if you look at the numbers over to the right, and if I'm going too fast or too slow, just wave a hand and tell me to slow down or shut up. So on, you see salary. So salary, the way we define it, is that's the annualized base salary only. So excluding any cash incentives, excluding any long-term awards like stock options, et cetera, excluding benefits, so forth. So for example, in the 25th percentile, median 75th percentile. So for example, at the small public funds, the median salary was 228. At the all public funds, the median was 303, private sector 464, and so on. The right-hand side of that chart is a salary plus bonus. That's salary plus cash bonus. So you see that for small public funds, there's a, on an aggregate basis, there's a small uptick in the total number there, a larger uptick from the all public funds, and clearly there's very large incentives in the private sector. Again, this analysis of the private sector, just so it's clear, excludes long-term awards. So if any of these firms have stock options or grants or restricted stock or deferred cash or mutual fund deferrals, et cetera. So in reality, the take-home pay for the private sector is even a larger number that we just, there's no point in showing it. You're not going to be paying that. So it's excluded. Also excluded from all of these groups is benefits. So obviously at most of the public funds, they all have very competitive DB plans, rich benefits. Et cetera, the private sector, also very good benefits, not so much on the defined benefit plan, but that's not included in any of the numbers. So we're looking only at salary and then salary plus cash bonus. So how we got to the reason why I skipped that page 3 is because I didn't want to jump into the recommended number without going to the detail of it. So what we did is we said, we did this apply discretion to these numbers. So we present the numbers to you, it's fact-based, you have them. Our recommendation comes from looking at a few things. One is, what's the broader labor market that you're gonna recruit from, which we looked at before. The second is there cost of living potentially higher or lower here? So we work with other public funds that are in Boise, Idaho, and their consideration is obviously the opposite of what you might have here. And the third is, you know, are the how well do these groups represent the job, the scope, responsibility, et cetera. So what we did was we looked at, for the small public funds, we said, well, they might be while they're smaller, of similar size, most of them are located in those Boise, Idaho areas, et cetera, middle of nowhere. We do have a cost of living reference in the back, and see that they're in much lower cost of living, lower paying areas. So our recommendation is, what we referenced is to say, let's look at the midpoint to the high end of the small public funds. Let's look at the low end to the midpoint of all public funds. And let's look at the low end of salary only for the private sector. So if we looked at those numbers, we kind of triangulate and we said, well, let's not get too scientific. And we didn't use like averages and to get to some like 22.0175. We said, put on a reasonableness hat and say, if that's the focus of our analysis, what's the range that makes sense to us? And we came up with 250 to 300. And again, that's not a mathematical number. That's just, we looked at those numbers and said, what's the range to us that makes sense given these peer groups? So our recommendation of 250 to 300 came from looking at that market segment there. There must be questions.
So 250 to 300 is kind of a broad range. Can you kind of talk about if you were to come up with an actual, you know, dollar amount or a smaller range, how you would do that?
So our philosophy here is we're recommending a range for the position, not the person. So this is the position of chief investment officer. So the 250 to 300 would say, if you're hiring someone with either less experience, less tenure, et cetera, lower end of the range, if you, we'll still talk about the Powerball assumption here. If you're hiring someone new, And they have either more experience or they're, quite frankly, they require a higher salary level because that's what they're currently making. Maybe you would hire them at the higher end of the range. So that's what the range is for. Again, sort of less experienced, less pay requirements with low end of the range, and that gives you a $50,000 band to let that person progress over time to the high end of that range. If you found someone with the exact, you know, midpoint of the experience that you were looking for, and sort of was the average, you know, somewhere in between there. If you look at your current situation, so if I go back to page 3, in your current range, as we understand, is 153 to 189. We would say that going from 189 to 250 at the low end of the new range is a pretty big jump. We're not going to sit here and try to say that's not insignificant. It's a significant change. So our guidance would be to consider two things. One is the if you were to adopt the recommendation as presented, and I understand the incumbent is already at the high end of that range, we wouldn't expect necessarily that because he's at the high end of the current range, he would need to be at the high end of the new range. Instead, we would say put a little discretion into one, approving the range, and then two, deciding where the current incumbent should fall. So on one hand, you could say from 189 to 250 is a significant jump, and if we do accept that range, going from 189 to 250 is enough. We don't have to bring him into the higher end of the range. On the other hand, you could say if this person does get offers from other places and is being recruited by locally, you have lots of universities, endowments, other public pension funds, again, they're much larger, et cetera, just with an hour drive, their offers will be you know, actually over the top end of this range in the local area. So the range is there so that you can have flexibility to hire the right person. So you might be able to hire in the lower end of the range, higher end of the range, et cetera. And then when it comes to the current incumbent, you need to balance what, if you were to accept that 250 to 300 range, you know, what is an appropriate jump based on where the person's currently situated.
So when you compare CIOs, you're looking at a position at a firm or a company or a fund that is that title, irregardless of what their specific duties may be within?
We have McLaughlin conducts several hundred compensation surveys across the globe. So what we do is we ask each participating organization to read our position descriptions, and based on the content of the job, match the person. So in some cases, someone with the title of chief investment officer might be matched to a lower or higher level job based on the description we have in the survey. So that, and that description in our survey is on page 5. So that description is there. It talks about typical years of experience, what responsibilities are, et cetera. So again, if you were to review that and say our position is much, you know, doesn't have nearly all those things or has much more than that, then obviously you have less discretion using this data.
Okay.
Other questions?
One might be just reading our description. We're talking about, depending upon the funds and investment approach, investment activities may be conducted through its external managers. I think that's basically how we do it.
Yes.
And or through internal staff. If you had internal staff using, say, the Yale endowment method, where they're actually picking individual securities, mm-hmm. That's a very different role. In other words, if using your description, we could be including people doing something very differently. Can you reasonably confirm that that's not what we did in selecting comparables?
Yep. So the data includes both organizations that have direct internal management, so like CalPERS has that situation, or as well as organizations that are more structured like you that are only manager. So only of the public funds we work with, about 20% have that internal management structure, 80% are manager only. Whereas if you go in the private sector, that is mostly internal security selection. So there's a handful of organizations like American Beacon or Hartford Funds or John Hancock that have that manager approach. But especially within the less than $15 billion range, most of the private sector will be folks with direct security selection 80% of the all public funds are a manager-manager approach. And then within the small public funds, just off the top of my head, I'm just going to go through quickly and see if I can eyeball names. There may be one or two within that small group that have internal management, but the rest are going to be all manager-manager. They're not at that asset level. It doesn't make sense to have the internal structure.
I think we talked earlier inside, and you said there were 237 Act counties that you used in this study, and that was the extent of it. And I think it was Los Angeles and San Bernardino, right?
Yeah, so the as mentioned before, the data set we used was restricted to the surveys and data that McLagan already has on hand. For better or worse, two of the 37 Act or McLagan clients, the others aren't. As we've worked with and spoken with those types of specific organizations and others in similar situations in other parts of the country, the feedback that we get is one of two folds. Either they are not able to legally change the salary even if they wanted to, so there's some organizations that are stuck, and others like yourself that have the ability to set salary, and in some cases, while they may understand where their competitiveness is lower due to political pressures or other internal equity structures, et cetera, they haven't been able to make changes, although they recognize that their salary levels are less.
So I'm assuming that in Los Angeles and San Bernardino, their trustees or their board has the authority to make the changes in salaries at any time.
That's correct. And you can look up their numbers as public, so we can tell you that broad range. Los Angeles is 300 plus, 300 to 400 range for their salary, and then San Bernardino salary plus bonus is in the $300 range, $300,000 range.
Yeah, but Los Angeles has 49
exactly.
Billion.
Exactly. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And you know, San Bernardino is close to us; they're 8.1. But I would have liked a little more influence on the 37 Act counties. I would have really liked to see a deming into. And I told you this. Deming into what their salary was. This, to be honest with me, I was expecting to see. I know our salaries have been low, and it's because we haven't been an independent employer, and now we have the opportunity. But I was somewhat surprised at how different the scale is from what we're now paying and what is supposedly going on in the private sector. So I was like set back after reading this and going through it a little bit. So, maybe it would have been balanced a little more with the other 37 Act counties, I don't know. But we have gotten those figures, though, so we can also look at those down the road, but otherwise, wow.
Other questions?
Any other questions of our guest?
You just covered the CIO.
Oh, you've got several more to go.
Yeah, so I was going to say, if you wanted to review the others, the punchline going back on page 3 is that your investment analyst, the current range of 97 to 118 is in the ballpark. So when we did our recommendations, we rounded. So whether or not you need to make changes is up to you. We said 1 to 125, you're already at 97 to 118. So for that position, you're already there. I understand you have approved or were working on, I don't know where in the system it fell, an investment officer position. So we wanted to present you with the salary range that we felt would be appropriate for that level of position. And again, that would be the 150 to 175 on page 3.
Yeah, with the investment officer, what are you looking at typically for the number of people that they would supervise?
So it could be none, to be honest. Investment officer at a smaller fund, usually that would mean that they're responsible for like all of private markets or head of private markets or head of public markets might be a functional title that person would have. If they do have staff supervision at the smaller funds, it might be one or two analysts, but oftentimes all investment staff report directly to the chief investment officer, and you know the junior analysts are kind of have like a dotted line to maybe a more senior person.
Okay.
That. Thank you very much, and thank you for
Your patience.
Wait, your patience. We had a longer closed session than we expected to have.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.